This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast for Monday, May 14th, 2018. Welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm Steve Lubetkin, your host, Podcast Steve on Twitter. In this program, we talk to people in the public relations, communications, and journalism fields about their activities. And we also present interesting seminar panels and conferences being conducted around the country. In this program, we present a couple of panels. We attended a PRSA New Jersey and Tri-State District Member Appreciation Night on May 10th, 2018. We enjoyed some drinks and some hors d'oeuvres at the Patria Latin Bistro in Rahway, New Jersey. And we heard two panel conversations. The first panel, The Art of Storytelling in the Digital Age, moderated by Michael Lauer of Johnson & Johnson, with panelists Chris Riata of Mediaite, Sid Katz of New Jersey Isn't Boring, Tanisha Friday from Johnson & Johnson was one of the other panelists. In the second panel, What's Hot? Leaders of the New Media School. We heard about influencer marketing from Stephanie Scott of First & Last PR. Natan Edelsberg of Muckrack and the Shorty Awards talked about social media. Shakira Johnson, the host of the event and the owner of Johnson PR and Events, talked about PR and events. And Samuel Mason, the CEO and founder of the Tesla Community Incubator Space. We'll get to the first panel right after this message from our sponsor, the book, The Business of Podcasting.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Now let's get right to our first panel, and to introduce the event is Shakira Johnson, the head of Johnson PR and Events.
So my name is Shakira Johnson, and I am the director of events for PRSA New Jersey. On behalf of our chapter, welcome everyone to our member appreciation night. A big round of applause for yourselves for coming. So a quick story is just that within the chapter on the board, we wanted to start doing things that really thanked our members and also was a perk of membership. So we last year partnered with PRSA Tri-State to bring you this event. And if you're a member, then you're here complimentary. And last year we had about half of the attendees, and this year it's doubled. And we think that as the years go forward, this will be one of our most popular events. So if you have any feedback on the event or any tips or suggestions or thoughts, please feel free to let me know, because we're always looking to improve upon this event. So again, on behalf of PRSA New Jersey, thank you so much for coming. As you all know, we have a wonderful chapter here in NJ. But I also wanted to just go ahead and thank our event champions for tonight and our panelists and our sponsors. So as far as our event champions, if you helped in planning this event, if you would just please put a hand up, go ahead, let us know so much. I see Stephanie there, Megan, where's our Michael, John, Natan, thank you so much for just helping me in planning this event. It is much appreciated. I also wanted to do a special thank you for Stephanie from First & Last PR, who took it a step further and brought her wonderful staff to help us set up and plan for this event tonight. So thank you so much, Stephanie, First & Last. I also wanted to go ahead and recognize any of our board members who may be here. So I see Ken Hunter there. Ken, thank you so much for attending. Do we have any other board members here this evening? Ken, thank you so much for being in attendance and for your service to the board. Last but not least, I wanted to go ahead and do a special thank you to PRSA Tri-State. They were so kind and generous to sponsor our event last year, and they were so pleased with the outcome that they went ahead and said that they would sponsor it again this year. I am hoping that they're even so much more pleased that they sponsor again next year. So this is my official ask right here and now. But again, Tri-State, thank you so much. I am just love the energy that Tri-State brings. I love working with Tri-State whenever I have the opportunity to do so. And I had a fabulous time at last year's PRSA Tri-State Conference, which I hope that I'm invited back to again this year. So without further ado, I know we want to get into these great, great, great panels that we have. Why don't I bring up Megan, who's going to talk a little bit about PRSA Tri-State. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Shakira. Let's give Shakira a round of applause for organizing this wonderful evening. I'm Megan Leinbarger. I'm the 2018 chair of PRSA Tri-State. So you might not realize this if you are a PRSA member in New Jersey. You are part of Tri-State. So congratulations, everybody. You did it. So PRSA Tri-State encompasses New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. So we're so thankful to have a partner like Shakira and Stephanie who are organizing these great events in New Jersey, because it really allows us to connect with the New Jersey chapter, which is really important to us. You know, one of our main initiatives of the year is our annual conference. So I wanted to let everybody know about that. It will be taking place October 17th. We actually just officially announced it. And just by being here, everybody gets 15% off the registration price. It's basically going to be a full day of these panels. So it's really educational and informative and a really great way to connect with the community and, you know, continue your professional development. So we really hope that you guys will all be there. Like I said, it's really, really meaningful to us to connect with folks from New Jersey. So yeah, we're excited to be here and excited to, you know, look forward to future events. And you guys are absolutely, Shakira, you better be at the conference. So you're more than welcome. Yeah, without further ado, let's get the night started and jump into these panel sessions. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
All right, so if we could have our first set of panelists, What's Hot, The Art of Storytelling in the Digital Age. Thank you. I am now going to turn it over to our wonderful moderator, Michael Lauer of Johnson & Johnson.
Thank you, Shakira. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for having me, and hopefully we're going to have a great discussion about storytelling in a digital age. Oh, thank you, Ken. So I'm glad to assemble a pretty good panel up here. I think we have a good diversity of opinion and thoughts here. So without further ado, I'll just ask the first question to all of you. So how has the internet and technology in general changed how we tell stories today? So John, I'll start with you.
For me, the biggest change about the internet and technology is that it's enabled all of us to become communicators and utilizers of technology. The thing that stands out to me the most in the last 10 years is the invention of WordPress. I remember getting on the internet in the early 90s and thinking, gosh, I wish I could build a website. And WordPress came along and I could do it. And I could teach, I work in book publishing, I could teach my authors how to do it, or I could build it for them quickly and easily. So it's, for me, it's the era of DIY.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's only going to continue to increase, right? Absolutely. Anyone else?
I would just like to add that it seems to be the way that people find out information more, especially with social media. I don't know how many people find out about their friends' engagements or birth announcements through Facebook or Instagram. And the ability to tell stories through those social media platforms is huge.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think it's definitely changed the way that we have worked. Normally, I think the first go-to for a communicator in the past has been a press release. And not that the press release is dead, because if you are, you know, in a global organization, press release is still alive in many different regions around the world. But it really challenges us communicators to get our story out there in a real digestible, snackable, concise way, and in a relevant way. And so I think that we have really been able to change the way that we've delivered our stories. And now that we are able to do it in the form of videos or boomerangs or, you know, memes, it is just, it's new and relevant, and it really allows us to open our eyes to a different way to talk about the different things that we want to promote.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would add what I agree with everything that everyone else said. I would only add that I think it certainly has leveled the playing field in the ability to gain access to information. You no longer really need to have some sort of, I'm a reporter and a journalist, and so you don't need to have any sort of local access to a story in a lot of ways anymore to be one of the first outlets to report something. For example, I've worked with an incredible journalist named Julia, and she's always one of the first 10 journalists in the entire country to be aware of a school shooting, because she's set up keywords on programs that she's created so that she can gain tweets from a 17-year-old in Oklahoma when they're saying, you know, I'm sitting under my desk and we're scared and we heard shots. So she'll be monitoring something while there's, you know, local reporters who are running to the scene, and she's all the way in Manhattan, you know, writing a story for an outlet. So it really has leveled the playing field in being able to obtain access and to spread that information like never before.
Absolutely. Great. And I apologize, we're going to rewind for 1 second, because I was so excited to get into the questions that we skipped introduction. So for everyone, I'm Michael Lauer. I'm a director of communications at Johnson & Johnson. I support our chief medical officer. So, John?
I'm Jonathan Tara from JTT Marketing. I work in the book publishing space. I have a main client called Watkins Publishing that's based in London, England. And I also work individually with authors on PR, shaping their ideas, marketing, and agenting.
My name is Sid Katz, and I run a website called NewJerseyIsn'tBoring.com, all about local tourism and things to do in New Jersey, really ranging from everything to day trips or just restaurant reviews. Anything that's going on in New Jersey, I try to cover it.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanisha Friday. I work in communications at Johnson & Johnson, supporting our chief technology officer and our consumer R&D organization. And a lot of the work that I do is public relations for the science behind our consumer brands, so like Neutrogena, Listerine, Tylenol, et cetera.
And my name's Chris Riata. I'm a journalist, a reporter, and I'm currently an editor for Mediate, which is a blog covering media and politics. I previously worked at Newsweek, and my work's been featured in Washington Post, International Business Times, and a few others.
Great. Thanks, everyone.
Good.
So, Sid, first question to you. I saw on your blog you just celebrated your four-year anniversary, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Very exciting. So what are some of the ways that you tell a compelling story to some of your readers?
Sure. So in the last 4 years, a lot of things have changed. It started with a simple WordPress website, which I built because I learned how to do one in a class. And I would tell stories and write about things I was doing. When social media became more prominent, Instagram had come out maybe around the same time. So at first it was just, here's a picture. Then it became, here's a hashtag. Then it became, now let's use Insta stories and really tell a day-by-day account of what you're doing. I mean, you could do that on Snapchat, on Facebook as well. But what I love to do is, if I'm covering an event or I'm going somewhere, I love showing it through Insta stories, because it gives you a full 24 hours of a day in the life almost, and it gives people ideas on things to do.
Great, great. And I assume also having a topic like New Jersey Isn't Boring kind of cuts through the clutter a little bit. You're not really competing with a majority of the other blogs and media outlets out there, right?
What I think is different about my site is that it is a website, absolutely, and you can go there and get information on anything at any time. But it's also a blog, so every blog post is written by me about my experiences. So whether I'm reviewing a diner, which I do every week, I review a different New Jersey diner, whether I attend an event or I'm doing features on different homemade ice cream places in New Jersey, which is another thing I'm currently doing, it's coming from my perspective. I'm pointing out what's interesting about it or what I find interesting about it, and hopefully getting people to visit those places as well.
Great, great. Chris, next question for you. So as you just mentioned, you recently just moved over from a very traditional site, a media outlet, Newsweek, to Mediaite now, which is kind of the newer technology-enabled type platform. And you cover a lot of variety of topics, I noticed, including social and politics. So how's that transition been, going from the quote-unquote old to the new?
It's been interesting. I think it's actually pretty fascinating, because I think I've learned in this short amount of time working for a newer website is that they're really looking for more of a voice behind reporting nowadays. And I noticed working for Newsweek and other older traditional publications, they're trying to learn from newer outlets and even newer blogs, like how do we gain or how do we keep a retention in our audience? How do we gain a loyal following? And I really think that it's coming down to people seeking out a personality behind their reporting, behind the content or the information that they're consuming. Most people don't gain their news and information from newspapers anymore. It's really coming a lot. Journalists are battling Seth Meyers and SNL and the like. So they're seeking people to just have a full brand and a full 24/7 sort of personality online. So I think in a way, researching and just being able to provide information is no longer the only responsibilities of a communications professional, and certainly for a journalist. I think now people are demanding that you also have sort of a full online reputation and brand behind you.
Right. Absolutely. Great. Tanisha. So as the corporate person on the panel, would love to know your insights, as you mentioned earlier, your role in communicating some really tough, scientific topics as it relates to consumer R&D products. What's been your approach, or what are some of the hurdles to telling a story in a digital age? So, on Twitter and in the age of Facebook, how are you kind of cutting through the clutter a little bit?
Yeah, so I think the biggest challenge has been staying relevant. And I think it's hard to do that, particularly for Johnson & Johnson. We're a 130-year-old brand, and people don't go to Instagram to hear what J&J is saying, right? And so I think, similar to what you were saying about the media outlets, learning from other smaller startups, we're doing the same thing. We have the Teladocs now, where you don't even have to go to a doctor's office. You just go on your phone, you FaceTime your doctor, you get what you need. There's so many companies that are doing really smart things on the grassroots level that makes it difficult for a company like J&J that has so many layers to go through to get something out so quickly. And so one of the things that we have been doing internally, and I encourage other companies and corporations, if you're out there, to do this as well, is having teams that are really built to be agile. And when you are trying to get something out in social media, you do not have time to have a 1 week turnaround. I mean, you're going to lose the news, right? It's going to be old by the time you get it out there. And so J&J, particularly in consumer, it's a little bit easier because we're working with brands like the Neutrogenas and the Vinos that are really active on social media, but really having people, almost as a war room ready to go to get things out there, and having the right people at the table to approve them, so that you can be, in those conversations, and that you don't miss out. And so I think that's one of the biggest things for us, is staying relevant and also timely, and not having to go through so many hurdles to get what we're trying to say out there in front of the people that we're trying to serve.
Absolutely. And I also think that's for a company like J&J, who has a lot of brands, a lot of resources, it gives us extra reason to ask for additional people to support communications, whether it be social or PR, because telling that story is much more important now, and the news cycle is just so much quicker that you can't, close up your laptop and worry about it in the morning, right? Somebody always has to be kind of minding the store a little bit. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, great. So John, I guess building on Tanisha's question about brand and telling the story, I know you work with a lot of different clients as well. How are you helping your clients, maybe some that are a little bit smaller than J&J, how are you helping them to cut through the clutter online in a digital age?
It really starts with understanding what the individual mission is of the author or expert that I'm working with. We kind of do a deep dive and say, who are you trying to reach? What is your story about? And then massage that so that we can find what the unique selling points are. I don't think it's that different from Neutrogena trying to cut through the clutter, or Mediaite. I love that story about the keywords. I mean, I think we're all trying to do that. We're all trying to like scrape the internet to get exactly to get the pulse. And I don't think it's different if you're small or big.
Right. But I would say a critical element of that is targeting, right? Knowing your audience and being very specific and very targeted. And some of the social platforms really allow companies and individuals to do that much better now, instead of just putting a press release out on the wire and hoping somebody sees it that you want to see it, right? You can go almost directly to them.
That's right. You know, and the thing that I was thinking about a lot when I was preparing for this panel was Amazon. You know, and I'm sure we all have our Amazon. So for me, Amazon is the search engine where I see where I fit in and I see where I can stand out. So before we do anything in book publishing, we go to Amazon and say, what's the landscape? And then how can we compete in that landscape? Where can we get an edge? And I'm sure, you know, Instagram is that for other communicators. Facebook or you know, PR Newswire, you know, whatever it is that's out there.
Excellent. So I started the panel by asking about telling a story today in the digital age. And so the question I have for everyone to kind of close out the panel, and then maybe we could take some questions from some of the folks here, is 100 years from now, right? Think about the evolution of 100 years ago, how storytelling was done. So 100 years from now, how will we be communicating to each other here on planet Earth?
Flying. In the air somewhere.
Yeah, we'll just be shooting messages into each other's minds. No, I you know, there's like this whole fear in my industry that robots are going to replace journalists and reporters, and maybe it's just wishful thinking, but I completely disagree with that. I think if anything, we're moving towards a space where people just want to see more personality and more of a voice behind the news and content that they're reporting, as I said, or as they're reading. So I think that there's always going to be a human element to communications, and there's always going to be, people are always going to want to see people delivering that information. It's about trust, and it's about building a certain sort of loyalty. I hope that in 100 years we won't be existing in this sort of bizarre space right now where, you know, it there's like this impulse to jump on content and information. And I think the problem for J&J is sometimes that it takes too long because there's too many people involved. And then for folks at Mediaite, you know, it's five guys, you know, a couple girls, a couple guys sitting in a room in Manhattan being like, well, this is a good angle on, you know, what Donald Trump just said in, you know, in the White House. And it can completely backfire and it can take down an entire company. So I'm hoping we'll all kind of find our footing in this reality that we're living in, hopefully.
Absolutely. Tanisha, it's almost like he works with
it. I know, right?
He nailed it.
Gets it. Yeah, so I'm not a medium or anything, but I, you know, so it was like, what, 8 years ago Twitter started, or 9 years ago, and we were all forced to communicate in 140 characters. And then recently, what was it, last year, they expanded that, so they weren't trapping you to communicate in 140 characters. So I would hope in 100 years that actually this whole, you know, being so short with what you're trying to say actually flips, right? It becomes a fad. Like, flares are back now, and, you know, I would imagine 100 years from now, people would be longing for long-form content. You know, I want a blog post. I want you to write a story that is meaningful to me and that gives me not just a brief synopsis of what you're trying to say, but the crux of everything that you're doing, so that I can really understand the story that you're trying to tell. So I would say in 100 years, it would be flipped, right? We would be going back to how we used to communicate, almost.
Very wishful thinking.
In a perfect world.
Sitter John, any final thoughts? If not, we can go to some questions.
Just one final thought. I was on the website today for Anthropology. Does everybody know the fashion store Anthropology?
Love it.
That, exactly. Could a robot do Anthropology? Like, I just don't think that that's possible. So that kind of, this space, you know, these walls, there's no robot that's going to be able to design. And I think that's, that element, hopefully, will otherwise, you know, bring on the nukes. You know, there's no reason to live, really, if we can't
What were you buying
beauty.
From Anthropology? I'm very interested.
I publish cookbooks, so I'm doing research, and they select the best cookbooks. You know, I mean, like, everything is so exquisite in those stores.
Excellent. Good. So I think we have a couple of minutes to take a couple of questions.
So can I say I'm
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm leaving. Well, I have to open up a webinar, and then I will be back.
Duty calls.
Yes, duty calls. So I will be around if people have questions for me. Maybe you don't, but wishful thinking again. So I'll be back later if you guys want to chit-chat.
Thank you, Tanisha. So questions from the audience before we wrap? Do we have mics?
Should I just talk loud?
Sure.
So, I mean, I can start. There's certainly been a shift to video. Companies in media call it a pivot to video, and they say normally when they're laying off half of their writers that they're pivoting to video. Actually, a lot of research shows that consumers they remain as interested in the written word as they always have. I think now it's just people are experimenting in this unusual space where we don't really know much yet. People are putting all of their resources into video, but until it proves to be something that can actually provide revenue for most companies, I think that we're just gonna continue to sort of go back and forth and figure out, you know, the New York Times has gained subscribers like never before in the past few years, and they haven't really invested too much into video as compared to many other websites, which have actually lost subscribers and have been plummeting since 2015, 2016. I think a little bit of that might have to do with the president calling New York Times fake news every day, but on top of that, I really do believe that people maybe are a little bit dismayed right now because the written word is sort of a lot more clickbait and kind of condensed 300, you know, words in an article, and people recognize that right now, so maybe they're not clicking into stories. But I think, as she said earlier, in a perfect world, hopefully we'll get back to some sort of trust and understanding that, you know, an article from a trusted or reputable source will give you information that you need, unlike, you know, a flashy video on your Facebook timeline. That's just my opinion.
Or we can go back to cave times and just communicate solely with just pictures.
Draw pictures on the walls.
Pictures on the walls. That's it.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Any other question?
It's something that keeps me up at night thinking, did I write a tweet in 2014 that is going to come back to haunt me, you know, from when I was just stupid or something? But I mean, it really has shown there are writers. There was a writer, Kevin Williamson. He's a conservative, pretty prominent writer who was hired by The Atlantic. And he penned it was a pretty, you know, disgusting tweet from years and years ago. And it reemerged because he was, you know, it was prominent that he was joining The Atlantic. And I think 3 days into the job, he hadn't even written an article yet, and he was let go from the publication. So, you know, I definitely don't agree with everything Kevin Williamson says, but you see reporters who sort of like walk this fine line and then occasionally step over it. And they are punished for it, and they're often let go from their positions. At the same time, when I was at Newsweek, we were getting, you know, weekly lessons on, you guys need to be building up your Twitter brands. You need to be posting on Google Plus every day, because who knows if people are going to want to start using that. Like, you just have to, you have, You have to be everywhere. You have to have a voice. You have to have a personality, but it can't be too much because you need to be credible and just the right amount. So it's like I said, something that I think we're still figuring out. I mean, I have like 30 drafted tweets that I've been like, let me not actually tweet that out right now. But yeah, it's something that you have to walk a fine line, and not everyone can do it, and it's unfortunate. Some people are really great journalists, but they're just not good at tweeting or, you know, posting on Facebook. So hopefully, you know, younger people in my industry can just, you know, try to educate the older generations and the people who are really good at this job, and they can teach us a bit about how to, you know, be credible and reputable.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? Are you Twitter first? Does Mediaite think of itself as really a Twitter with a back end where to send links to, or is that not the case?
It's not exactly the case. We tend to try to cater to certain markets more than just on a social platform. There are companies like that. Like I worked at Mike as one of my first jobs, Mike.com, which is sort of like a liberal social justice news outlet, and everything has to be put on Facebook within the first 5 minutes of publishing, otherwise it won't get a single click. Whereas Mediaite is sort of more tailoring towards people who are interested in Washington politics or, you know, media in New York City. But definitely there's been this sort of compartmentalizing of outlets trying to be, you know, Twitter's our space, Facebook is our space. Some people don't have any idea what their space is.
I think we might have time for one more audience question. Anyone? Okay, Chris?
Are there any, talking about digital platforms, are there any digital platforms that you may even be just exploring in a very nascent phase, or that you feel are, you know, we talk always about Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, but what do you guys see that could be the next up and comer, or the next platform that Johnson & Johnson may have to subscribe to?
I mean, I think it's always important just to look into the new trends, even if they crash and burn, at least you went on there. Like, I remember, I don't even know how many years ago, but I wasn't on Snapchat. My friend was like, you should be on Snapchat. I'm like, I don't really want to be on Snapchat. I'm doing Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I'm busy. Like, I'm running a website. It's just me. Like, I don't need Snapchat. So she makes me set up a Snapchat page. First few times I did it, I loved it, and then it just kind of tapered off. It didn't excite me as much as the other pages. And then what happened? Instagram and Facebook did the exact same thing. And if I'm already logged into those accounts, it's easier for me to do the stories there. And not to say that Snapchat is obsolete, there are people that still use it, but it's not for me. I don't use my account anymore. It's deleted from my phone. I'm just not there anymore. But there's always going to be new apps and new things to test out. It's just how the world works. There's always a college kid that's like, I came up with an idea. And it could be a dud within 6 months, or it could be the next big thing. So it's always good to just keep on top of them, maybe create an account, see where it goes.
Absolutely.
The thing that I heard December, January, and it seems to be proving true, is LinkedIn has really kind of surged in interest. Are other people seeing that in terms of being a viable outlet?
Yeah, and LinkedIn used to be a joke. It used to be like, oh, you're on LinkedIn, okay. Now it really is an important platform because for whatever reason, they changed it a little bit. I know that when I write a blog post, it immediately goes out to LinkedIn. I have it set up that the post will go right there. And then I get a lot of new contacts from there as well because they're reading my posts on LinkedIn. That's how they're finding me.
It's amazing. Great. Well, I think we're all done. So thank you, everyone on the panel. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for those lovely introductions. Again, I'm Megan Leinberger. In addition to being the 2018 chair of PRSA Tri-State, I'm a managing partner at a boutique PR agency called Zazeel Media Group, and I'm here with our lovely panelists. So let's go around and give introductions before we get started.
Hello again. My name is Shakira Monet Johnson, and I am the founder and creative director of Johnson PR and Events. We specialize in doing event marketing management as well as producing extraordinary experiences.
Now my name is Stephanie Scott, and I am the CEO and communicator in chief of First and Last PR. We are a boutique PR agency based in Jersey City, New Jersey, that specializes in the beauty industry for Fortune 500 companies and also niche brands, a lot of indie brands as well. And I'm also the founder of First and Last PR Foundation. You've already heard the plug from Linda. I won't repeat it, but feel free to check us out.
Hi, everyone. I'm Natan Edelsberg. I work at a company that created Muckrack, a technology platform, and the Shorty Awards, a big award show for social media. I'm also the past chair for PRSA Tri-State, so really excited to get to know the New Jersey chapter and members and colleagues more.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. So we're here to talk about the new school of media. So getting into influencer relations, social media, and events. So let's start out with the theme of tonight, what's hot, what's not, what's next. So I'd love to hear from you guys. What do you think is hot right now in PR and marketing communications? Stephanie?
I think what's hot is, I want to say like disruptive communications or just what's not from before. So I think most of us, my background, I started out as a beauty editor years ago, and I switched into working in-house for a skincare company, and now I own my own PR agency. But I think when clients call and they're saying, you know, what can you do for us and what is PR, I think we can all agree that it's no longer just writing a press release. It's no longer just pitching print, which is my background, and I love print. And it's not just pitching online. I think that it's also incorporating your influencer strategy. It's also dealing with bloggers. It's also developing content. We're constantly writing content, whether it be for trade publications, whether it be for blog posts, whether it be video creation. And if you would have told me, you know, 10 years ago that part of my job would be creating videos for our clients, I would have thought you were crazy. But now it's just part of the services that we're offering. So it's more of a 360 program. Events are also really huge. And I think that with the rise of social media, what consumers are liking more is the fact that they can actually reach brands. They can communicate with them. There's no longer that like 1-800 hold music, I don't know who's actually making my products. But instead, you go onto our Instagram stories, you can actually see people in the labs, you see them creating things, you see them putting things out, you see founders working out and shopping with their families. And so there's more insight and it's more personal, it's more reachable. So I think that what's hot now is actually having that connection. It may not be in person, you may not be able to touch people yet, but I think that kind of coming into someone's home through your phone makes it so much more personal now. I think that's what's really hot.
I want to piggyback off of what Stephanie said, because events are hot because they take exactly what you said, but you make it so that it can be touched, right? So in terms of events, I would say what's not or what's out is cookie cutter, boring events that just kind of are shuffling people in and out or going through the motions. Rather, that's a mastermind event for top producers in your company, or rather that's a consumer or customer event. They need to be, I would say, customized as much as possible and really inspire a sense of FOMO. And for those who don't know what that is, that's fear of missing out. And that's basically
one of my favorite terms.
Really?
Oh, I love it. Yes. I know. And I'm the biggest FOMOer of all time. Yes.
If I wasn't on this panel, I would have FOMO.
Exactly.
Can we tweet you on that, Megan?
Yes, please.
So at your events, you want people to feel like they had to be there because something that's going to take place or took place at that event cannot be duplicated online, or even if you read about it, it just wouldn't be the same. So you want that for the people who attended your event to feel like they were a part of some very special experience that in a sense could never be duplicated. But then also you don't want to have, again, events that just feel like they just went through the motions of creating this. You really want events that are experiential.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot already. I agree completely about events. We just had our 10th annual Shorty Awards, which honors the best of social media. It was our biggest event ever, and we're just seeing it grow and grow and grow. So there's this need for people to get offline. I think another thing to just take a different angle that I'm noticing from the kind of PR side meets technology is customization is really, really hot right now because I think it's easier than ever before to customize your media relations. I'll disagree a bit with Tanisha, who mentioned on the last panel. I think the press release is way beyond dead. I think it's just irresponsible to do press releases at all anymore. And I know many of us still have to do them. But I think the lack of creativity, the lack of need for customization, it's really not necessary anymore. And any time a big organization like J&J or a small company decides to do a press release, to me it just says that you haven't figured out a more creative way to get buzz amongst media. Even the SEC said you no longer need to publish a press release on a wire service. As long as you disclose, you can post it on social media. So I definitely think press releases are not hot. And I think what you're seeing now is that's really hot is lots of new technologies to allow you to customize one-to-one outreach. It used to be very difficult to take a list of 100 people and send each of them a customized message. And it's still not the easiest thing. You still have to customize it. But there's a lot of both tools to do this, whether it's in your Gmail or elsewhere or Outlook, to just personalize your outreach at scale. And that never existed before because there weren't companies creating apps to do this, workflows to make this easier. And so I think from a media relations perspective, I think anyone who finds themselves doing BCCs or putting stuff out over a wire service, not only is it proven that it doesn't work, but there's so many great alternatives, many which have seen a lot of popularity rise in 2018.
Okay, I can't totally disagree with what you're saying, and I think all of you hit really, really important points. And there's so much I want to talk about, but one thing that Stephanie, you had mentioned is social media and being able to, you know, reach out to your, you know, end audience directly, which in some ways kind of bypasses what we as publicists are doing, which is talking through media. So I want to talk about how are we making social media part of our outreach plan while still maintaining that media relations aspect of our jobs. And whether you're an agency who needs to prove your worth to your clients and show them that you have these relationships that they should value when they can in fact go straight to their customer. So how do these two things work in tandem, you know, versus just bypassing it entirely?
I think it has to. So I think that when you're pitching, I think that social media can support what you're doing in like many different ways. And I think it's like how you look at it. Mm-hmm. So it could be social media that is amplifying the message that's going on. It could be working with bloggers because things can happen in a real time. It could be posting on Instagram because that you can control and how you tell your story. But the same way that the first panel was saying, I think Sid was mentioning being on certain platforms around every platform. So it's, but also when you're on those platforms, it's, you know, what content are you putting up there? So the same thing that you're putting on Facebook, maybe that doesn't go on Instagram, or maybe it's similar, but there's a different voice or there's a different video. It's how you're actually using it to engage your audience. So I think that social media amplifies your voice, and it depends on the timing of what you're launching, the timing of the news, and how you actually put it out there. That is going to make the most impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I wanted to add to it the social piece of how it references with events. So back to what's hot. So what's hot at events is, number one, going live. So this concept of being at events, going live, giving people a sneak peek as to maybe what the behind the scenes are, maybe some chatter that they wouldn't have otherwise heard or seen. Having people also have access to things that they're not even really invited to. So imagine you have an exclusive influencer brunch or something like that, or think about even, say, the Oscars. Probably none of us in here are invited at this time, right?
Says who?
Right. My invitation's in the mail for next year already. But we love to have that Oscar cam so that we can see, you know, behind the scenes, or we love that Grammy cam so that we could see, you know, someone, you know, freshening up right before they go on the stage. So definitely in terms of social media and events is having an active social media strategy for whatever event that you're doing. Yes, we know hashtags and encouraging everyone to use hashtags at events, but then really also having someone who's just dedicated doing either whether it's an Insta story or a Facebook story or going live or, you know, putting content together that is basically going to be then showcased on social.
Mm-hmm. Anything?
Yeah, those are all very good points and ideas. I think the only really tactical things I'd add in is I think, you know, social media, I use it as a way to just help me do traditional media relations. So simple things like if you're ever pitching a journalist but not paying attention to what they're doing on Twitter first and really searching and doing that research well, you're going to mess up your pitch or not get as many results. Like we heard from, you know, Chris on the last panel, you know, the fact that he's so worried about a tweet from 2014 shows how important Twitter is to him. And he's still writing on a news website. So that's one thing, just like do intense amounts of research on journalists' public social media presence. And then the second thing is, whenever you pitch now and are engaging with media, it's not enough just to think about getting your story placed. That's probably the ultimate goal and the main goal and probably what the client wants. But the second goal is to get them to share something. And the simple way to do that is once you do get a bite and you see there's some interest or you wheeled someone in, have a Instagram ready graphic to go, have something for them to share on Facebook and LinkedIn and make sure it's the right dimensions and all that, since journalists, as we know, have sometimes followings that are way greater than the outlet that they write for. Like Chris didn't mention it, but he won like one of Donald Trump's fake news awards. Like one night this year, Donald Trump tweeted like 10 journalists that he hates the most for producing fake news. And Chris was one of them, and that's something he's tweeted about because he tweeted about it. That's how I knew about it, because he was proud of it. But, you know, it's it just shows how important the individual followings of a traditional journalist, and it's equally as exciting to show a client that, like, hey, I got this journalist from the New York Times with 50,000 followers to share a link to this social good effort we're doing. Often way more impactful than them even writing a story about it.
Very good points. And I think it's, you know, when you're working with a client or if you're in-house and you're communicating that to your, you know, upper executive level, just showing them that it's not that social media is taking over. It plays a huge role in everything that you're doing as a publicist and a, you know, a marketer. So I actually want to jump into influencer relations because I think this is, you know, a whole new beast that we're trying to figure out. And in a lot of ways, I mean, in my opinion, I think it's very similar to your traditional media relations. Maybe let's just start off by, you know, what do you guys define as influencer relations and how are you, you know, working with influencers, if at all?
So I'll start with, so I just did a stint with Liberty Science Center, and so we were doing external events primarily there, but their influencers were very different because what we would do is we work with a lot of international pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, and so they would have their top scientists, and maybe the general public doesn't know their name, but internally, those people were a huge draw. And those events, they would have either the sales teams or other representatives come to those events. And they would want to just put together an extraordinary experience for those scientists and those people doing R&D. And again, they would bring in some cases, just scientists from around the world to come in and talk. So I think influencers really depend on your group. So you can't necessarily just take, you know, this person who maybe is super popular and put them and stick them with the group and think that, okay, this is gonna have an effect there. Influencer marketing, it does work and it does draw interest, but you just have to really be careful about who those influencers are because it really does vary depending on who the target audience is.
Kind of want to let you go first. I feel
sure. Sure.
Every time I say something, you.
I don't even want to be in this seat. I thought I was going to be at the end.
Should we do musical chairs now?
Yeah, we can
now
definitely switch around. I thought I was going to be on mic four, but that's neither here nor there.
I think my company comes from a kind of unique angle because we produce an award show that honors influencers. So we've gotten to see kind of the industry be created, and we like taking some credit for validating it because the same way you win an Oscar and it helps you get your next big movie, we like to think when...
So you've created this monster that we're all dealing with.
We very much want to take credit for helping grow the monster. I think there's... it's really hard because it's kind of flipped the concept of earned media upside down because it's hard, like as the influencer industry gets bigger, most influencers won't, you know, don't believe in earned. You know, the trick is, though, they publish a lot of content that they're not getting paid to do, and it might be influenced by someone. They just won't admit it. So whenever you try and pitch them the same way you'd pitch a journalist, it just clicks, oh, give me money. So you kind of have to find creative ways to influence them, either via social good efforts, finding people who know them, or finding things that they like really, really care about or need. And then I think the other big thing we've seen is there's, you know, influencers and micro-influencers. I describe influencers as people with like Instagram or YouTube followings that are at least 1 million. And once you kind of hit the 1 million mark, you get to charge a lot more. You just kind of, and I'm making up 1 million, but somewhere around that. But when you're below that, they're like, you know, micro-influencers that have everywhere from, you know, 10,000 followers to 70,000. They could be a scientist. They could be someone in the fashion world. They can be anyone. And I think those people are often way more valuable because they're really, really targeting a niche area. They're trying to become bigger, so aren't as, you know, don't have as big egos, and are often open to opportunities that make sense for them. So I would try and think about it that way. And be ready to like be pitching a manager or an agent, because many of them do that, and be ready to really justify why you shouldn't be paying to do something with them and why it's to their benefit to do.
What I find, and many of you probably find the same thing, so we pitch journalists, print, online, bloggers, and influencers, and I pitch them all the same, because some influencers, micro, when they like a brand or may want to just try something, they may actually write something or tweet something or do an Instagram just because they actually like it. Every now and then that will happen. But funny enough, I was pitching earlier today before I came to this event, and influencer's automatic reply automatically hit and said, "This is a serious business inquiry. Please contact my manager." I'm like, "I was just contacting you to see if you want to write about this Mother's Day story. Like, I don't understand." So, but that's the old school journalist in me, because when I was a journalist, we wrote about things that were newsworthy. It didn't matter if we were getting paid or not paid, and I understand that it shifted. So I think a lot of the companies that we work with now understand that. They understand the shift, and so I think it's how you're looking at your dollars. So maybe you spent X amount of dollars last year in advertising, traditionally in print or on radio or TV, but I think that what companies are doing now is they're finding out that those need to go into influencer programs. So a lot of the launches that we do will look at influencers first, and we may say we're gonna target 10 macro influencers, or we may mix it up 10 to 20 macro and micro, and we're gonna send them product ahead of time. They're gonna test it out, we're gonna develop the hashtag, we're gonna make sure they know what's going on, we're gonna get them buzzing about the product. And so we did a launch recently where that exact thing happened. About 2 months before the product was launched, we started to work on our campaign, sending out the product, having the influencers try it out. And by the time that we did our mailing to regular press, these influencers already started talking so much that everyone could not wait to get their packages. And literally, we saw so many Instagram stories where people were freaking out. One of the bloggers said, "I was about to go on my workout, my morning jog, but this package came and I knew what it was." And she's like, "I don't know if I should go on my workout or not." She's like literally freaking out on her IG story. And so she didn't go on her workout. And instead she like did a whole day full of stories of unboxing and trying stuff out and just kept talking about it. I think that builds up to the FOMO we talked about, because everyone else said, "Where's my package? When is it coming?" Then come the emails to us saying, "Did you forget about me?" And we say, "No, it's on the way. It just hasn't gotten you yet." So I think that there are ways to work with influencers of all sizes, but I think we have to, as practitioners, we have to acknowledge that this is the way things are going. And so there are ways to work with things in real time with influencer social media, and also work with traditional in the same way. Not everything is going to be earned, but I think that the smart way of strategizing is understanding that is a possibility, and how do you want to control your content? How do you want to control your voice and what's happening? And how do you want to work with the influencers? A lot of them now want to own their brands. They want to own their voice. They want to know what they're saying. And they want to work with you on creating that content. So I think it's not just us saying like, hey, here's this new product and I want you to write this story or put up this post, but it's letting their creativity happen, let them flourish and their brand, giving them that power so that they can be who they want to be, and then letting everything kind of go from there.
Yeah, that I totally agree. And I think, you know, really just like we do really need to rethink the press release and how we're communicating what we believe is newsworthy. Thinking about budgets and reallocating in ways that are more effective and, you know, ideally will give you more control over your brand voice through these influencers who align with your brand, you know, is extremely impactful for us as communicators. I want to talk about so much more, but we're actually out of time. So we're going to open it up to some questions from the crowd. Anybody have any questions for our panelists?
Just the way you pitch stories nowadays. Are you doing it the traditional way you've always done it, or are you doing it differently now that things have shifted?
This was not planned. We actually use Muckrock.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. So I believe that the press, and having said that, I think the press release is, I think there's a purpose for it. I've never been a big person on putting it on the wire. That just to me, I don't think it's personal at all. And so I think that you can use tools like social media and like Instagram. So we definitely pitch. I mean, we'll come up with a concept, we write. I think you need a press release just for factual information because sometimes journalists will get it wrong. What are the main ingredients? What are the pricing? So that's attached to your pitch. But I think that every pitch should be personal. And a lot of the feedback that we get from bloggers or journalists, that what they like about how we approach them is that it is very personal. We've never BCC'd. We don't send out mass emails. We don't do like a MailChimp press release. It's just no, you know, because I don't want them talking about our clients' products that way. I want to get to know them. We'll do events or we'll do things that are more personal to kind of reach them. So I think that has to be that connection. And I think also it's like knowing who your journalist is. I think that's also where your databases come in and they're really handy so that you're pitching. If I'm pitching a car story, I'm actually pitching the person who's in charge of autos. I'm not pitching the home person who writes back and says, why are you sitting in this pitch when I don't cover this section? So I think the more that you can tailor what you're doing, really hone in and also develop those big stories, because it's not just about a product placement. You know, it's really about those feature stories and developing these relationships and getting these big stories out there. And I think it's really connecting with who that person is and really getting fine-tuning your pitches that makes it really special, and that's what gets you the larger stories and the clients are happier that way.
Are you finding it like to be you finding success to be different when you actually pitch your story? You're finding that different outlets are actually responding to these pitches compared to what you used to do?
It depends. So with print, there's so much merging. So I'll take like Hearst magazines for example, and I still haven't figured out like how that's happening, where previously, back in my journalist days, you have, you know, an editor and an editor team for one magazine. Now they have groups. So if you reach this one editor, she may be responsible for five different magazine titles. And now with your prints, a lot of them print magazines also handle the online versions. So I think you have to kind of know the vehicle is the same. I'm still pitching you what the news is, but I have to know, is it .com? Is it going to be a social media post? When we go to do a desk side, it's going to be a live interview that's going to go up on their Instagram page or their Facebook page. I think it's knowing all the different mediums that the media has available and then knowing where the best thing is, and also trusting the journalist that they also know their outlet. So they'll say, you know what, this isn't going to be right for print, or we just finished that issue, but this would be great for online, or we have this thing coming up or a conference coming up, and can we build it in that way? I think that's also how the platforms are also responding. They're not just giving you a print version anymore. They're giving you live experiences. They're giving you social media. They're giving you Facebook Live, because they know they have to compete with everything else that's going on right now. Sponsored.
FCC.
I think, yeah, they legally have to.
Yeah.
It's the ones that don't that you should watch out for.
Yeah.
I find that, like, so many influencers, like, people don't care that it's an ad. Their followers will still go and buy the product, which is a big shift from, like, a commercial. When you think about, like, Matthew McConaughey driving a Lincoln not many people, that's what's going to get them to like go out and buy a Lincoln. It's like, you know, I'm like, yeah, does he even really drive a Lincoln? I don't know. But when, you know, you see an influencer, there's this almost like belief from their followers, whether it's true or not, I don't know, that like, wow, they thought it was cool enough to take money from this brand to post it on their Instagram. They would only take money and do this if they actually thought it was cool. So I think people truly think that way when it comes to the influencers they follow, because it's not an ad on a mass medium. It's like this individual personality they adore.
One of my favorite influencers that I follow, her name is Tiffany the Budgetnista, and she has a, I think it's called the Linda rule, where it's Linda's her youngest sister, her baby sister, so she says that everything passes this Linda rule. So basically, if she's recommending it, she would recommend it to her very own sister, right? So I feel the same way, Natan, that if she posts something, that she would actually recommend this to her sister. Now, you know, it may be, you know, slick marketing, or it may be fact, right? But I believe it because it seems honest, it seems authentic.
Thank you guys so much. And thank you everyone for listening.
Can we do one more question? Can we do one more?
Can we do one more?
We could do one more.
Okay. She's the boss, so we can do one more.
Can we do one more?
Raise your hand.
Okay, here, let's go to this table right here.
Yeah, I was just curious. I've targeted various writers that I want to cover my niche, but they move around so much, it's hard to contact them. Is there a particular etiquette for contacting someone on Twitter or other social media?
On Twitter?
Yeah, like tweeting them?
Like, I know where they are.
I kind of feel like don't, only because I feel like when people are on Twitter, it depends on what you're tweeting, and it depends on what and how you're contacting them. So people are like, hey, if I'm like tweeting, oh, like I can't wait to go on my vacation, and then someone's like, twit whatever, it's annoying. Unless you're like, oh, I used to follow you or something, or you could DM them, but I kind of feel like when people are on Twitter, they don't want to be pitched. I don't think you should pitch someone on Twitter. I think like indie brands do that because they don't have any contacts, but I feel like if people move around, you can always ask them, like, oh, I see that you're not doing that. They might be kind enough to tell you who's now covering it or get muckrock. But I feel
thanks.
Like, yeah.
But hashtag ad.
Yeah. Hashtag not sponsored. But I feel like just tweeting people, I think people want to have fun on social media. They don't want to be, like, pitched.
Yeah,
you can stalk them.
Just to chime in, I have seen some will say that it's okay. I think sometimes they'll specify if they don't mind you reaching out. But a lot of times it's better to just try and create a genuine connection with them and use Twitter for that. And like, make it genuine. Like, don't like, oh, cool, I love that sweater you're wearing. Hey, do you want to see this product that I'm trying to sell? Like, you know, just try and create a real relationship. And a lot of times that's going to get you way further than you even thought that you would go.
And I would also say be professional, because we've even done some talent procurement from social media just because maybe we were trying to get that person's contact and we asked them what's the best way to contact them, and then they'll supply that and then we'll do it. But I would say don't be like, hey sis, love your, like, you don't know them, you know what I mean? So I would just say be even professional when you are, if you're going to, and we're hearing both no, but if you for some reason feel like you have to DM, or just understand that you don't know that person, and while it may feel like you've been hanging out for 5 years because you've been following them for 5 years, they don't know you, and they're getting a lot of DMs and a lot of people may be reaching out to them. So just be succinct and be professional if you do choose to DM a person for contact and ask them, you know, what their preferred method of outreach is.
Awesome. All right. Thank you, our panelists, Shakira, Stephanie, and Natan. Thank you, everybody, for being here tonight.
Great job, Megan. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, so let's have another round of applause for this panel. So this panel really is like a manifestation of my goals and hopes and aspirations. So like, for me to be on a panel with Stephanie and Natan and Megan is like my own personal dream team. So I'm so happy to have done it with you guys. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I want to just thank everyone for making their way to Rahway on this fine evening to spend some time with us. I also want to invite, if you are not already a member of PRSA, to consider being a member of our fine organization and attending more of our events. We are looking to do more of a blend of networking events. People do come to our events and find employment or network for interview opportunities. They also network for sponsorships, network for connections, and then just network because we're all nice, great people, and it's good to know people who live in your town or work in your town or whatever that may be. So if you're not a member and you're interested in membership, please let me know. Again, thank you so much to all of our champions from this evening. It was a pleasure to work with you. Thank you to our wonderful panelists and our moderator, Megan. Thank you so much for preparing the questions. You did phenomenal. And also, we will still be here for about 20 minutes, so feel free to enjoy the music, enjoy a little bit more beverages, a little bit more festivities and networking, and everyone get home safely. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed hearing these panel conversations from the PRSA New Jersey and Tri-State District Networking and Member Appreciation Night that was held May 10th, 2018 in Rahway, New Jersey. If you want more information about PRSA New Jersey, you can email info@prsanj.org. I'd also like to remind you about my book with Donna Papacosta from Toronto, Canada. It's called The Business of Podcasting, How to Take Your Podcasting Passion from the Personal to the Professional. It's available on the Amazon Kindle and in trade paperback. More information at thebusinessofpodcasting.com. We produce this program in the studios of Professional Podcasts. It's one of our own Lubetkin Media Companies, based here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We're on the web at beingthemedia.com. For everybody at the PRSA New Jersey chapter and at Professional Podcasts, I'm Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.